This episode of Pub Talk Live was broadcast on April 25th, 2020, with guest co-host L. Penelope and special guests Sarah Megabow and Angelina M. Lopez. Hello, everyone. Hi, welcome. Welcome to the April 25th episode of Pub Talk Live, the live publishing talk show airing the second and fourth Saturday of every month at 9 p.m. Eastern. I am your host, Sarah Nicholas. I'm a young adult author, a board member and agent liaison for Pitch Wars, and a library event planner. Just a reminder, you can subscribe to reminders via email by clicking on the link in the description so you don't miss a show. You can also follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at Pub Talk Live. And if you'd like to support the show, you can find a link to the Patreon near the end of the video description down below. So I want to bring on today's guest co-host. Leslie Penelope has been writing since she could hold a pen and loves getting lost in her worlds in her head. She is an award-winning author of fantasy and paranormal romance. Her novel, Song of Blood and Stone, was chosen as one of Time Magazine's top fantasy books of 2018. So please welcome to the show, Leslie. Hello.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me. Hey.
Thanks so much for coming. I'm excited. Sarah asked me to, so I invited Sarah Megabow first, and she's the one who hooked me up with Leslie and also our second special guest that you'll meet in a bit. Hey, Heather. Hey, Jessica. Thanks for coming, Jessica. Celeste, hi. So I don't know if y'all noticed, but I had an animated intro now. I am learning how to use After Effects. And so that was like the first thing I did. So
you did it yourself. That's awesome.
Heather, so welcome, Leslie.
Thank you.
And I'm also in a new location. You probably can't see much except for my backdrop, but I moved and now I am filming from my sister's house because she has way better internet speeds than where I live now. So, thank you, Heather. I'm like absurdly proud of it because it's just like some silly little thing, but it's fun. I'm glad I made it. So today, I just wanted to say, make sure you go vote in the viewer poll if you haven't already. And I'm going to drop that link in the YouTube comments. So you can go vote. And the question is, how has your income, publishing related or not, been impacted by COVID-19? And we'll discuss the results of that survey at the end of the show. So Leslie, how are things where you are?
Things are pretty good. I'm in Maryland. And okay. So yeah, we have the lockdown order and the masks are mandatory. So I've been buying masks left and right. I started buying them 2 or 3 weeks ago on Etsy. And so every couple of days, new masks come. So I just have this collection growing.
Nice. I have a Ninja Turtle one and one that has like all these little kitties on it. It's like,
oh yeah. I love the cool patterns. I got one yesterday that has a bunch of planets on it. Oh, man. I've gotten different patterns, like these African patterns and then some just regular black ones, but
yeah, we got mask fashion now.
Yeah.
which Japan has had for a while. So
yeah, we're catching up.
All right. So a lot of things happened in the last 2 weeks in the publishing industry. So we're just going to dive right into the news. The American Library Association's Office for Intellectual Freedom released their annual list of the top 10 most challenged books. 8 of the top 10 were challenged due to LGBTQIA content. And the other two were The Handmaid's Tale, which was banned for profanity, and the Harry Potter series again.
Yeah, that's so crazy. I wish they had shown like where exactly these books were banned. And
yeah, well, I think they have a little more information. And so we are, by the way, if this is your first time watching the show, every news item that we talk about is later tonight, there's going to be a link in the description. So if you want to come back, you can read more about each item. And there's a little bit more information there. You can see all the top 10 books and you can also see like the numbers and stuff.
Yeah, it was, things just start getting banned and that's pretty crazy and sad. And I just wish that, I wonder if there's more protests going on that you hear about, like in terms of the response to that.
They do mention that a lot of, so these are basically like reported challenges, right? So like a lot of times challenges aren't even reported, like probably 90% plus of the time. You wouldn't know that a book is challenged because it goes through like this private process at the library or the school. So for example, at my library all the time, the children's librarians especially are like, I have to read this book because there was a challenge.
Oh, okay. That's really interesting to know. Okay.
And most of the time the challenge is, I don't know what they call it, but like rejected basically. And the book is kept, but.
That's cool. So librarians are on the case. There's free speech.
Tamara's cleaning her shower while watching. All right. Welcome.
Good for you. I wish I had the energy to do that.
Asking.
So Harlequin adds a non-disparagement clause to their freelancer contract, which would affect editors and designers, et cetera, but not authors at this point. It prevents them from making derogatory statements about the company, not just during their term of work, but forever.
Yeah, you brought this piece and I was like, forever?
Right. That's super scary and very troubling. Like, you could understand not wanting to disparage the company you work for while you have a contract with them, but like in perpetuity. So maybe that'll get challenged at some point, but it's something new that they added recently, which is crazy.
And especially because I feel like Harlequin, especially, there are a lot of valid critiques that go around, you know, related to Harlequin. But now no one can talk about them. No one who Harlequin has paid anyway.
Right.
We'll watch that. And I know there's been conversations about these kind of statements and contracts anyway, like in general, not just in the publishing industry, trying to figure out whether or not they're even constitutional.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's free speech and then there's private companies. And I know that there's questions about that, but it's.
Yeah. So I wouldn't be surprised if we saw a court case come out of this at some point.
Right.
Okay. So why author Danielle Clayton, who full disclosure is a friend of mine and also has been on the show before, reported a pretty terrible experience on a recent Zoom school visit. Did you hear about this, Leslie?
I did. I saw her tweet about it. Yeah.
Yeah. Attendees repeatedly unmuted themselves to call her the N-word and make fun of the teacher's weight. And this kind of sparked a conversation online about virtual event safety. And so there's going to be a link in the description. You can read more about what happened.
Because we've heard about Zoom bombing, but these were actually people who were supposed to be there, who had gone through the process, that they had taken the security measures, there's a password in place, and they were just doing this of their own volition. So,
yeah. Well, this is kind of a weird thing, but it's been a frustration of mine for a couple of weeks. So I'm an event planner. That's what I do for my job. And then I also do the video streaming, obviously. And I definitely see people doing things. And I'm like, you should be doing that differently. You should be, you know, these different things. And I think a lot of people who are doing a lot of this, like online video streaming content, whatever, they're just not aware and they're not as comfortable with like the software as they should be to prevent this kind of thing. Because the exact thing that happened to Danielle during this thing could have been prevented pretty easily. But I think it's just, if you're not using that software all the time, you may not know all the different things that you can do.
Yeah, that's true.
Because I know like several of my authors from some of my events have contacted me since this happened. And I'm like, no, I have this in place and this in place and this in place. And they're like, oh, wow, that's extensive. And I was like, I know. but that's who I am. I have Excel sheet for everything.
But it's sad that you can't just trust people
I feel like I tweeted this and I feel like the fact that the students or whoever it could be felt entitled to do it in the first place, is the problem. Yeah. But I would like, if there are any teachers watching and you don't know about this, it's actually pretty well known that, so when you do a Zoom thing like this, they give you a link and a room password, right? But it's a multi-use password. So like multiple people can use that same password.
Okay.
And it has been a thing where, especially in high school, students will put that meeting room link and password on Reddit and ask people to come in.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
So if you don't know that, you might want to prepare for that. Yeah.
Oh, that's too bad. All right, so Book Expo and BookCon have been officially canceled, which was an inevitable and long-awaited announcement. Frankfurt has announced they still plan to move forward with an October date for their book festival.
Yeah. We've been talking about this actually for a couple episodes because people are basically like, when is BookCon going to cancel? Because by the time they canceled, every major publisher and, oh my gosh, what's the distributor's name? I can't remember it right now.
Like Baker and Taylor or?
The other one besides Baker and Taylor. I feel like Sarah just messaged
Ingram?
It.
Ingram? I don't
PGW. No, yeah, Ingram. Yeah, you're right. Ingram pulled out. And so everyone's like, no one's going to be there. How is this going to happen?
Well, also, because that's at Javits, and people were saying, I was talking to someone who goes to New York Comic Con every year, and they haven't officially canceled, but I think they're moving in that direction. And she's heard from readers that are like, I don't even want to go to Javits because people are dying there. You know, like
yeah.
People are sick. And so I think that's going to be a concern for at least some people, when even once this is over and things get rescheduled, where you have a place like that where, you know, these tragedies have happened. How do you make people feel comfortable going there in large numbers again?
Yeah. When is New York Comic Con? Do you know?
It's usually October, beginning of October.
Oh, October.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dragon Con was just posting on Twitter that they plan to go forward, but
wow,
I can't imagine going to an event with 85,000 people
yeah.
in the fall.
Like, when will we be comfortable
I will
with
be
that?
Going. Right. Other people can go. So in the last report, in the last episode, we reported on the Artist Relief Coalition. That was created to provide emergency grants for artists by multiple different organizations. They received 55,000 applications for the first round. And the first round, they gave out $205,000 emergency grants. There will be four more rounds of grants to come, but I think just the fact that they had 55,000 apply is really says a lot. You know, they have a lot of people are really in need right now.
Yeah, and there's a lot of different organizations and funds giving aid, and they're all being completely overwhelmed by the need. So I hope that people are able to get what they need from somewhere. But yeah.
Oh, hey, Mackenzie. I just like to say every now and then hi to people coming in.
Sure.
You have a related news item.
Right. The Authors Guild surveyed its membership about the impact COVID-19 has had on authors. 54% of their members said their income has declined in recent weeks, with many of them saying it was due to speaking engagements being canceled.
Yeah, I know a lot of authors, especially authors who do school visits, like this has been a huge thing for them.
And I saw that, and I was actually impressed that so many authors are getting paid to speak, because I know that's an issue sometimes when we're asked to speak a lot without any sort of payment. So on the plus side, it's nice to see that they were going to get paid for it.
Yeah, a lot of school events, especially, you get paid for those. And then at my library, we do several author events where we pay authors, but it's usually like big name authors,
right?
You know,
yeah.
The mid list, it's a little bit harder. On May 5th. Some good news for the foodies out there. Penguin Random House will publish a digital cookbook with proceeds benefiting restaurants and their workers. It's called Family Meal, and it will feature more than 40 exclusive recipes from PRH published chefs. So I'm kind of excited for that.
Really?
It is digital, yeah. Okay. I don't know, I just love cookbooks. So if you look at my Book Riot history, you'll see I write a lot about cookbooks.
That is cool. I usually just search for random recipes, but
I do that too, but but I cook a lot, so yeah.
So
especially now.
Right. Oh yeah, me too, definitely. Along the line of grants, the Science Fiction Writers of America, We Need Diverse Books, and the Maurice Sendak Foundation, along with many other organizations, have opened up grants to help writers weather financial downfall due to coronavirus. More about each of these programs, we have links for them, so they'll be found in the description later on tonight.
Yeah, so if you're looking to apply for any of these grants, make sure you check out that list. There's gonna be four different links for you. What a time, you know? So many people are really suffering right now.
Yeah.
And, or even if they're not suffering yet, they're anxious about the future, you know? So
there's so much uncertainty, and like you combine just the emotional turmoil with the economic turmoil, and it's just a bad combination. So,
yeah, I know, like me personally, I still have my job. I'm still working full time from home, but the future is a little uncertain. I'm an event planner, you know,
right.
Like,
yeah.
For a library, which are also, they're having troubles right now. So,
right. That's great that you have your job still. You're doing like more online events, I guess, right?
A lot. I told a friend the other day, I was like, my entire life is video content right now. Because my job, and then I'm also the lead video producer for Everywhere Book Fest. Oh, I should have put that on the list. I'm going to just go ahead and talk about it right now. Everywhere Book Fest, May 1st and 2nd, is going to be an online book festival that focuses on kid lit. So picture books, middle grade, YA, and graphic novels. And there are some really great people there. And so I've been pre-recording some of the pre-recorded panels, and the one for Black Voices Matter was amazing. I mean, like, I'm a huge fan of Jason Reynolds, so I'd probably say that anyway, but yeah, it's so good. And there are also going to be live panels so people can ask questions and interact as well with the authors. So
very cool.
Yeah. But yeah, video content all over the place. So this is like a weird piece of news that I saw, and I was just like really fascinated by it. The Hanson's Auctioneers, which is like a famous auctioneer house, has discovered a copy of Roald Dahl's first book, The Gremlins. It is signed to a friend of Dahl's from World War II, to John, who wrote the bloody thing anyway. if you read more about it, you'll find out it was a guy that he served with in the war. And the Gremlins is actually based on, pilots used to talk about gremlins like causing technical problems on the airplanes. And so he just made it into like a children's story, basically. But I'm assuming what happened is, like, while they're, you know, together, waiting for their next flight, they probably just like developed this story together. So I just thought that was fascinating.
Yeah. And it seemed like his estate was kind of trying to walk it back a little, being like, oh, we don't know how much this guy contributed, but I mean, he wrote it. I wonder, it kind of seems like it's half joking, but yeah, not, you know.
Yeah, I feel like it's something you say to your buddy who's like, you know, like I have a friend, Dragons Are People Too, my first book came about because a friend told me the title, like she was messing around, and I asked her for a comp title for the book I was writing, and she said it, and I was like, I've never heard of that book. And she's like, oh, I just made it up. And the whole concept came out of the title, you know?
Oh, wow.
So yeah. It's like, well, she kind of, she didn't write the book, but she right. really helped a lot.
It takes a village. Yeah. My critique partners help so much, like, mm-hmm. you know, brainstorming and just ideas. And what if you did that? And I'm like, that's a great idea. And so,
yeah
all of that goes into it. So Michelle Obama has partnered with Penguin Random House and PBS Kids to host a weekly read aloud series called Mondays with Michelle Obama every Monday through May 11th on the PBS Kids Facebook page and YouTube channel, which is amazing.
Yeah, I first found out about this. We got a little press release at Book Riot, and they were wanting us to write a story on it. And I was like, ooh, I may tune into that, even though it's for kids.
I know, you know? Right? It's like, we're looking for anybody named Obama to save us in any way they can right now. So.
Yeah. And I listened to Michelle Obama's audiobook. She narrates mm-hmm. Becoming herself, and it was really good. So we know she can, you know, read a story well. A little bit of sad news. Many indie bookstores have reported problems with receiving their payouts from GoFundMe. Sometimes receiving unexplainable error messages, and one case being told there was a freeze on their funds. And it turned out to be a mistake, but it seems like maybe GoFundMe is like a little overwhelmed right now.
Yeah.
And, it's causing a problem for probably not just indie bookstores, but a lot of small businesses.
And probably just people, if they're having cash flow issues, or, I mean, because it sounds kind of shady, but you think the money is going through them. So there's no reason why they couldn't pay it out.
Yeah. So. I think it's probably more on technical error, you know?
High volume.
Yeah. I mean, I understand from the indie bookstore side, you're like, oh, we were worried, and then we're excited because we raised all this money.
Right.
But, oh, wait, you can't get the money yet. It's probably a pretty stressful situation.
And it sounds like it's taking weeks. Like, it's taking kind of a long time if they really need it immediately.
Yeah, and they're trying to pay people,
Yeah, keep the lights on.
Yeah.
So Books A Million launched a new Talk to a Bookseller hotline where you can get recommendations from their category experts. There is a number to call, 1-866-544-1468, to use the service. I think that's kind of a cool thing because book recommendations are going around, and if you are used to going to a bookstore and like talking to people, talking to the booksellers there to get recommendations, this is a nice substitute in our new world.
Yeah. Yeah, and it gives the booksellers something, you know, it keeps the booksellers employed at least somewhat.
It gives them something to do and something to think about, people to talk to. It's nice.
So last, I just want to answer Celeste's question. Are travel accommodations costs usually covered when the author is asked to speak travel for a speaking engagement? And the answer is, it depends.
Yeah, usually is a tough word, sometimes.
Yeah, it really does depend. So sometimes you're not offered anything at all. Sometimes you're offered only travel and accommodations. So that's kind of like when I speak at writers' conferences, that's usually what happens for me is they pay for the plane ticket and the hotel, and that's it. Right. And then sometimes your travel is covered and you're also paid. And then sometimes, and it's what my library does, even though it's not my decision, is we actually offer a lump sum and include travel in that. And so the author books their own travel. Some authors like it because I live in Orlando and they like to like extend their trip a little bit. it also, I don't like it because then that entire chunk of money gets reported as income for the author.
Yeah. So.
But our finance department is in charge of that, not me. So, yeah. Well, that's all the news that we have for you this week. We wanted to make the news section a little bit shorter because we actually have two special guests that we're going to bring on today. So the first one is Angelina M. Lopez, who has been writing professionally her whole life. First as a journalist for an acclaimed city newspaper, then as a freelance magazine writer, and now as a romance author. She writes sexy contemporary stories about strong women and the confident men lucky to fall in love with them. Her first book, Lush Money, is available now from Karina Press. Her second book, Hate Crush, will be available June 29th, 2020. So please welcome to the show, Angelina. Hi.
Hi.
How are you?
I learned a lot. I learned a lot during the news segment.
Oh, cool.
I have a book on deadline and a short story on deadline. And so my head's been pretty down and focused and off social media. And so you guys gave me the update. And I feel like I'm enriched. I know what's happening in my writing community now.
You're ready.
Awesome. Great. This is great information. Some was cool. Shocking. But yeah, thank you. That's great information.
Thanks.
And our next guest is Sarah Megabo, who is a literary agent with K2 Literary out of Highlands Ranch, Colorado. She's worked in publishing since 2006 and has been an avid reader her whole life. Sarah, welcome.
Yay. Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Sarah, we have four special guests here, not just two. It's nice to see all of you.
Thanks. Everybody's special.
We're all special.
Yeah, this is what I call the interview guest because interview guests sound silly. No special guests.
Thanks.
How are you two doing? How's everything going on your end of the world? Yeah?
Sarah, you go first.
We have a tiny little townhouse and a teenager.
Enough said. Okay.
All you need to know.
It's funny. These are very first world problems, but I found myself very thankful today that we have three bathrooms.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Which per person is like... place.
Like one bathroom per person is amazing. And I had a list going. I was sitting outside in the sunshine with an ice cream bar and I'm like, you know what? I'm thankful for bathrooms. I'm thankful that everybody's healthy. We're, that question about the money going away is pretty terrifying. But we're healthy, thank God. So
yeah.
Angelina, how are you on the other side of the country?
Yeah.
Yeah, everyone is employed. I had two college age sons. They're both home and living here. And one was a freshman who was living in Chicago and so they're both going through this their own thing and they're healthy. there's money, you know, they have, they, that, you know, they're fed, they're in a home. And yet I keep telling them, I, my freshman was living in downtown Chicago, essentially, you know, living the life of an adult to come home and to be a kid again and have kid rules. And I'm like, this is not, and not only that, he was working, he was saving to stay in Chicago for the summer. I was like, it is okay to mourn.
Yeah.
Yes, we have a billion blessings.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean you're not going to have an emotional reaction to everything you're losing out on right now. And it sucks.
Right.
And there's no like, but there's no silver lining here. Like it's okay to mourn all of these lost opportunities. And yet, and yet still be empathetic to other people's situations. I heard this great quote, my cousin posted it, that somebody said, people keep saying we're all on the same ship. She said, and this writer said, we're not on the same ship. We're in the same storm. Mm. But everyone's ship is different. And while we have to be empathetic to other people's ships, and they're all, you know, dealing with different waves, we also have to be forgiving of ourselves. And I thought that was a great way to describe it, because everyone is, we're just, this is a crazy thing we're dealing with. So, so we're doing well, but it's, everyone has something. So it's interesting. It's an interesting time.
I'm trying to get through it. Yeah. I know for me, I had planned for a while to move in with my parents when my lease ended, because I need to save up some money. Like I'm looking at a job change and a move. And so I want to, you know, save up some money for that. But also at the same time, it's been a great, like really, really comfort to me, because I know that since I moved in with my parents, I don't have a lease. I don't have to pay rent. Like if I do lose my job, it's going to be a lot more easy for me than it would be if that hadn't been the plan, you know?
Sure. Yeah.
All right. So speaking of, let's go ahead and get started. Sarah, I know this is a big ask, but can you give us kind of a report on the state of publishing? Like how is COVID-19 going to affect the industry in the short term and maybe also in the long term?
I can answer that from my own perspective.
Yeah.
I always think of publishing as a gigantic sphere or pie or something like that. And I know my slice of the pie really, really well. I come from a data analysis background. So like I really intimately know my slice, but my slice is just one slice. So another agent may have a totally different answer. Mm-hmm. So I only work in Big Five publishing. Leslie's published by Macmillan and Angelina's published by HarperCollins. And I only work in genre books. So that's novels for middle grade readers, novels for young adult readers, romance novels like Angelina's, fantasy novels like Leslie's, and science fiction novels. So the answer could be totally different for nonfiction.
Yeah.
But what's going really well is that if people have disposable income, they're buying books. That's going really well. Ebooks and audiobooks are wonderful for authors. They're less wonderful for bookstores.
Yeah.
We really need print book distribution in order to keep the bookstore, the bricks and mortar bookstores healthy. And that's what's not going as well, because a lot of the bookstores are either closed or they're closed for curbside pickup only or something like that. So what's going really well is that the disposable income is going towards books. And I know for my own family, that's what we've been doing, is it's kind of like my grandpa. We keep going to the mailbox every 3 days going, ooh, is there mail? Because I keep ordering boxes of books from bookshop.org, which is a website that buys from indie bookstores and gives back to indie bookstores. Mm-hmm. And I'll buy three or four manga and two or three novels and a couple client books to give away to friends. I just buy stuff just to give them money. But it's like, you know, presents have arrived. And that keeps us going, is buying books. And so that's going really well. Bookstores are, and libraries, that's what's tough. So today, I think the toughest position to be in today is for the authors that are launching a debut book in March or April or May. Secondarily, people who are waiting on the option clause, which is, you know, your next book deal, a lot of times the option is reliant upon good sales numbers for the first book. Well, hardly anybody's going to have good sales numbers right now. So that's a little bit of a concern. And then, of course, people who have books coming, you know, books on submission or books coming out later that fall under a different umbrella. It, you know, there's just a lot of questions. But I would say the best news is that people are buying books, and the less best news is the fact that bookstores and libraries are having a hard time because they're not open.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah, that makes sense. So kind of in that vein, publishing changing, and romance publishers shrinking, what is your feeling about the future of traditionally published romance? Because I hear things about some kinds of romance are just going to indie, like publishers are just abandoning it to the indies. Are you seeing anything like that? And I know Angelina is a contemporary romance author with a traditional publisher, so that's good news. But overall, what are you seeing?
Overall, at the big five companies and at the very, very, very aggressive mid-sized companies like Sourcebooks and Kensington, Houghton Mifflin, Angry Robot, these publishers are hungrily looking at data to look for opportunities. If, for example, contemporary romance has been very, very strong for, let's say, 3 or 4 years, that doesn't mean that the publishers are flushing historical romance or paranormal romance. It means that we are focusing our investment and our time and our energy in what's working. So it's like put our money where things are working. Mm-hmm. And that if I am a historical author, that might feel like I'm being flushed, but what it really means is that the contemporary romance authors are getting more of an investment. Mm-hmm. Is publishing a zero-sum game? I don't really necessarily believe that, but what I just said sort of sounds like that. Does that match with what your experience is or what you hear?
Yeah, it's hard to know. I mean, I see people getting published in all different genres, not so much paranormal, but mm-hmm. historical, contemporary, definitely.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then even trad publishers dipping their toes into sci-fi romance, which mm-hmm. does really well in indie. So mm-hmm. it's hard to tell. It's hard to get a big picture view of things.
Well, and the big picture we also have to realize is we have to quantify what really well means.
Mm, yeah.
Right? So for a big five publisher, the end game is bookstore and library distribution. Mm-hmm. And a big five publisher wants to look at their P&L statement, which is a profit and loss statement, and look at the comparable titles for a book that they want to acquire. And they're looking to see, can I put 20 to 40,000 units in print into bookstores and libraries. Mm-hmm. Now, we only have 650 Barnes & Noble left. And Barnes & Noble is not each going to take 1,000 copies, right? So we have to, at the acquisitions board meeting, the editor is playing this big game of chess. Okay, if Barnes & Noble buys in 3,000 units, which would be a pretty big buy, right, mm-hmm. for a mid-list yeah. author, and the indie bookstores are going to buy in this number, and ReaderLink is going to buy in this number, and ReaderLink is the company that buys for Walmart, Target, Costco, grocery stores, etc., and Amazon only buys the number that have been pre-ordered by readers, does that number hit 20 to 40,000? Well, or 60. If I'm Penguin Random House, I want 60 to 80,000, mm-hmm. right? So if that number doesn't match up, there's no offer coming in. If I am writing science fiction romance, are there science fiction romance books in print that have 40 to 80,000 units in bookstores? And if there aren't, a debut science fiction romance author might not get an offer. That's sort of now there's 1,000 different shades of gray in there. There's 1,000 loopholes in there. But that's in general how the process works. The publisher's customer is the retailer, the bookstore and the library. Mm-hmm. So the end game is bookstore and library distribution. Now, of course, if a publisher never acquires a science fiction romance author, then there's never going to be data proving that science right. fiction romance authors sell. And the publishers are not looking at ebook numbers, because if we sell 1,000 ebooks and we make $1,000 in profit, and next year Amazon sells 2,000 ebooks, but for $1,200 in profit, Amazon says, hey, we've grown. Mm-hmm. And the publisher says, hey, we've gone backwards, because mm-hmm. the publishers are looking at money and Amazon's looking at units. Okay. So if somebody says we sell really well, they're probably talking units, not money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's a lot of publishing speak. I apologize. Angelina, does that
matter? I love it.
I mean, yeah, you have a debut in contemporary romance. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. All my information comes from Sarah.
Of course.
Yeah, my information comes from Sarah. So no, yeah, I completely agree. It is, we have a new opportunity coming up with Lush Money that the can't say too much about, but one of the reasons the new opportunity came about was because it was Lush Money is ebook first, and it was difficult for the publisher to do what it wanted to do with it as an ebook first book. So, but in terms of people looking at the ebook numbers and what do they mean, for a lot of people, it doesn't mean a whole lot. And yeah, we experienced that they're still looking at a more traditional sales model, it sounded like. I'm getting from more people, a lot more experience than I am.
Can I jump in really quickly and ask Angelina another question? This is, it's kind of touchy though. So you can delete me, Angelina, if you don't like it. When we were on submission with Lush Money, what was it about Lush Money that had the publishers looking at their P&L statement going, ooh, this one's a little risky? And I know the answer, but I'm curious if you remember what the answer is.
That it was a feminist romance novel? Was that what, yeah, I mean, it was. It was a book doing something a little bit different on pushing a little boundaries. Yep. And Karina Press was interested and looking to take risks that the traditional print publisher that needed to make these kind of sales numbers was too nervous about making. And in fact, we did have a quick response from a big five, you know, print deal that was saying, I love this book if you make her less feminist. And Sarah rightly said back, okay, maybe. And I was like, no, it wasn't going to work. Right. But no, that ebook, we could take chances and risks. That risk fortunately paid off. But we could take risks and chances that we couldn't do with a traditional print deal. Yeah, you're completely right.
And it's kind of mind-boggling because romance is 80% women readers, and they're scared of a feminist romance novel. So
that was exactly our response. Yep. Was a little bit about what the reader was looking for. We had a different point of view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but Leslie, to your point, if we look at the print sales numbers, and I mean by sales numbers, I mean the number of books going from the publisher to the retailer. Mm-hmm. We don't see a lot of hyper alpha heroines. That's not quite the right word. Super alpha heroines.
Yeah.
Selling. Right.
I mean, you still have a pretty large segment of romance readers who have conservative views, you know?
Right. So I get that, definitely. Yeah.
But I mean, the wall, to be overly generalization, that's not a word. The Walmart reader, you know, was buying cowboys. Mm-hmm. And if the P&L statement says the Walmart reader wants cowboys, then the publisher is financially motivated to acquire mm-hmm. more cowboys.
Mm-hmm. All righty.
It's like Moneyball. It's like the movie Moneyball.
Yeah.
You know, it's not.
Wouldn't that be great to see a movie about the P&L statements and like. Dude,
I would rock that. I would tap dance on that movie. This stuff is like so my jam. Oh, look at the data. Career letters are not interesting. Let me talk about data.
Okay, so can you guys break down for us the agent-author relationship? I know every relationship is different, but how does your collaboration and communication work?
We drink together.
Or apart.
I actually am not drinking tonight because I can no longer either fit in my clothes or in my skin.
How does that? I mean, I am astonished by, I have actually said this to Sarah. Sarah and I met in 2009 and really did hit it off. And then, and I submitted to her and she said, this book isn't ready. And I was like, that's absolutely correct. The book wasn't ready and I wasn't ready as a writer. Continued to write, then took a break from writing, went back to writing again, and submitted to her again in 2018. Sarah said she took it out of her slush pile. She didn't immediately remember me. And but in this, you know, query letters, one page, you know, two-thirds of a page. In that, Sarah had a sense of, yeah, I want to see 50. I want to see the full. I want to continue that process. And the way that she can communicate with me about what I need to know, the way she can pull me off the wall when I'm climbing it, all of that started with this single letter. And for her to be able And for a phone call conversation, there was one phone call conversation where at the end of it, she said, I'd love to offer representation. So I think a lot of it is for an agent to have those kind of chops where they're having that ability to read stuff in a person relatively quickly. She said the right things all along the way in terms of that beginning process, and then has been just such an incredible coach through it all. A lot of what I need from her is, again, to pull me off the wall. That, you know, we go in thinking we're educated. We go to all of these, you know, meetings and workshops, and we talk to friends, and we think we know. And then the process of publishing starts, and it's completely different than what you expect it to be. And Sarah is a great moderator in terms of just, this is what it really is. And I don't know, she tells me the truth, I think, consistently. So it's trust. I guess that's the ultimate answer to the question. It's a trust that she's never let me down.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank Sarah, you mentioned before we got started, you're not heavily editorial, right?
Right. The way I describe it is, when I read submissions, I'm looking for something to sell. I'm not looking for something to work on. Mm-hmm. Then that being said, what I love doing is once an author has an editor, then I usually let that team work on the editorial. But mm-hmm. most of the time, an author then either has another project they want to work on, or doesn't get their option book picked up, or is inspired to try something in a different genre, or only got a one book deal and so now has to work on the other, or didn't sell the first book and so now has to work on something else. Then I become very editorial, and that's the process. Okay. Leslie, you and I have gone through this process. Angelina, mm-hmm. you and I might not have yet gone through this process of, hey, list me the things that you're interested in writing. Okay, let's flesh these out. Let's talk about these. And then at the point that we say, this one sort of matches the market, it matches the strengths in the books that I've seen before, mm-hmm. We have to have some opportunities here, then the author usually will send me, like, we'll work on it and send about 50 pages, at which point we can say, no, we're not liking it. Let's shelve this idea. Or yes, this is really working. Or the author says, I love it. And the agent, like me, says, it's not working. And that can be uncomfortable. But it's way better to be uncomfortable at 50 pages than 400 pages in. Mm-hmm. So that's when I get editorial.
I feel like I missed the question. Sorry, I was just like skimming through my question.
And I feel like the sun is going down, I'm turning sort of blue. I'm gonna work on that. There's no lights. It's fine.
It's fine. The light changes.
I'm super blue. We'll do this. Well, but see, if I do that, then if my kid walks upstairs in his underwear,
you become one of those Twitter videos, right? That you're gonna see last year.
Viral for the first time ever. I went through a similar process after the two contracts that I have were complete. I sent my agent like 9 concepts that I wanted to work on. And I was like, can you let me know? Like, what do you think? And she's like, well, not that one, but all the rest of them are good. Like, that didn't help at all.
That sounds like a you problem, Sarah. Too many good ideas.
Well, I bet if you asked your agent, Sarah, that most agents would probably agree with this, that every single author requires a different kind of help.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I know for a fact, and like, I'm not saying this to brag, but I'm pretty low maintenance. Like, I'm not an extremely emotional person. You know, I'm not a very, well, I have anxiety, but not that kind of anxiety. And so, yeah, I feel like I don't need a lot from her, you know, whereas I know some other people need a lot from their agent in terms of support and that kind of thing. Yeah. Though I would really like a hard deadline. That's what the number one thing that I need is if I have a deadline, then I can meet it. But right. If I don't have a deadline, I'll just keep going forever.
I do know, though, I remember when I was starting the agenting process, the query process, and I talked to some writers about, you know, what questions should I be asking? What should I do? And the number of writers who said, I'm astonished, a number of published writers who said, I'm astonished by how many people are afraid to email their agent, or they're afraid to call their agent, or they're afraid to ask for help from their agent, that it becomes such a process of feeling grateful and being afraid of pissing them off, that it becomes this relationship where they don't feel like they're in a partnership. They feel like they're more, and the number of authors that said, and I don't know that I've had anyone say that to me directly, but I had a couple of authors say, don't be in that relationship with that, with an agent. If you're, and if your agent makes you feel that way.
Right. There are certain agents, right, I've heard of certain agents who kind of make their clients feel that way. They yeah. like to be sort of like high, the person on the hill, the gatekeeper, and they try to be unavailable, as unavailable.
Yeah,
as
possible. That's right. Being unavailable. That's
yeah.
Right.
I just want to say it's hilarious that you brought this up, Angelina, because this is actually one of our questions that we had coming up that you had no idea. So we'll skip that one when it comes to it, because we've already talked about it.
What not to look for an agent. Yeah, I was intimidated by them.
I was talking to my critique group and I was like, my agent's had my book for this long. Is that reasonable? Like, when should I contact her? And one of the people in my critique group is like an editor, and she was like, just contact her. Yeah. Like, you know, it's not.
Yeah.
It's
fine. I mean, I feel like when somebody sends me work, I tend to try to write back and say, I should be able to read this for you by beginning of next week or mm-hmm. in 2 weeks, or I have three people ahead of you in the queue. You should hear back from me. I feel yeah. like I do that, but
you've
I feel
always done that with me.
Well, but yeah. my authors are equally respectful to me. You know, you'll say, okay, I'm going to have this done in a month. I'm going to have this done. I feel like when somebody says, this is when I'm going to get this back to you, I go into my database and I write down, okay, I talked to Leslie on mm-hmm. April 25th and in the whatever, she said she's going to have it back in a month. Mm-hmm. Okay. So then, you know, as I'm checking my databases, if 6 weeks go by, I can go, oh, where'd that thing go? Mm-hmm. And that never happens. If somebody says they're going to give me something, they tend to do it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Sarah's responsive to the point where if I just have a question and I don't want her to drop anything to get to it, I'll let her know, this is not urgent, get back to me when you can, because that takes the pressure off of me too. Then I don't have to be like, is this a stupid question? Is it? Indeed, it is a stupid question, but you can get to it whenever.
There's no stupid
on the couch kind of question.
Yeah. And the flip side is if you're afraid to talk to your agent, sometimes there's miscommunications. Like, there was just an anecdote I heard from another author whose friend, the agent had the manuscript for like 6 months, and she had been afraid to contact the agent. Finally contacted the agent, and the agent was like, or she had thought the manuscript was on submission. And the agent was like, oh no, we're not on submission. You didn't tell me to submit that. And it had been 6 months.
Oh my God.
And so contact your agent, basically.
Yeah.
Wow. All right, we are running almost on time, but I did want to get this question in from a Patreon supporter. So if you support the Pub Talk Live Patreon at $5 or more, you can submit questions ahead of time. So we have a question from Lodestar for Sarah and Angelina. And also, Leslie, you can answer this too. How do you handle if there are big creative differences between you as an agent, as an author?
That's a fabulous question.
Yeah.
Well, let the authors, I'm not sure the three of us have had that situation, but let me think of my answer if you two have anything you want to say.
So the only thing that came close, I had given you like 100 pages of something I was working on, and you had feedback for me. Mm-hmm. And I ended up not having enough time to work on that because of my contracted stuff, but I will be going back to it. Mm-hmm. And so it was kind of like, okay, take the feedback, and it's like you have to trust your agent and figure mm-hmm. out what, you know, do you listen to this person? Do you trust them? Do you have that relationship with them where you're respecting their feedback? I do think there's a certain point where if you totally disagree, when you're really on the same mm-hmm. page, you have to be honest about that mm-hmm. and then decide where to go from there, whether it's like self-publish or mm-hmm. is it time to, is that relationship done? Is that where it's gone? I mean, that might not be the case for just a difference of creative opinion, but I think if it happens often, then mm-hmm. it's probably, maybe that's not the right relationship for you.
Was that the portal fantasy?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm glad you're going back to that because I still remember the pitch and it's really strong.
I really love that book. I think that's the next thing I'm working on. Like, I was going to email you next week once I look at it again, but we'll see.
I do. There is this meeting of trusting your own instincts and trusting your agent's yes. instincts and his years in the profession. When the big five person did come back with a long, revise and resubmit letter and would love to take again. And it, because it was such a good publisher, Sarah did say, she did say, this may not work, but maybe you can try it. Maybe you can mess with it for the next month while we were on submission for other things, mess with it. And I spent 2 days maybe. Mm-hmm. And I went back to Sarah and I said, I just can't. It's ripping my soul out to do this, to change this book this fundamentally. And it's not going to work. And she said, then stop right away. But still, I think because that was really the first situation like that, would have been very easy to be like, well, my agent told me to do it and take the next whatever month of crying at my keyboard. So there was this meeting of, you know, in the trusting my own instincts, trusting her, and that conversation went me saying, I cannot do this. And that she said, then stop doing it.
Yep.
And that's when, you know, again, that being at the beginning of the relationship, then that sets the pathway for the rest of the
relationship. So that story jogs my memory, and I have the answer. The answer is that, let's say somebody sends in, we've submitted book one and it didn't sell. Let's just say, and somebody sends in book two and it's at 50 pages. And I write back and say, these are my ideas. If the author then says, no, I disagree, there's four options. There's my number four, there's four options. One is that the author edits, like Angelina tried to. One is that the author edits. Mm-hmm. Two is that we shelve the book and move on to something else. Three is that the author self-publishes the book. I do not take 15% of that. And they have my full blessing to do that. And four is they part ways. We part ways. And I will write that in the email anytime that I have somebody who sent me something that I have, that they disagree with my feedback on. And it doesn't happen that often, but I'm glad you said that story, Angelina, because that reminded me. It's always a four bullet point conversation, which is the author tries to edit it, or we shelve it, or the author self-publishes it and I do not take 15% of it, or we part ways.
All right.
And that was Lodestar that wrote that. That was a good question.
That was a good question.
I know a lot of people worry about that.
Yeah, no, I'm so glad that came up. Yeah. And I'm so glad, Angelina, you brought up, and Leslie, you brought up trusting your own gut, because you're right. That's part of it too.
Yeah, it can be hard as authors.
Oh God, yeah.
It's like the biggest challenge, right? So Angelina, your road to publication has been rocky and full of ups and downs, but you managed to consistently be an inspiration to other writers. So I wanted to ask you, what keeps you inspired when things are getting really tough?
Keeps me inspired. You know, I tried to step away from writing. I did step away for 4 years. I aspired to step away several other times and just couldn't. Even in that 4 year period, there were still the story ideas coming. And there is that inherent sense of wanting to write and wanting to create. And I think most of the people who are willing to spend the hours a day when they could have been doing so many other more enjoyable things. If you've got that compulsion, then it's really something to listen to because it's very special. And how many times you have someone telling you, yeah, but I want to write a book a day, one day, or I'm going to write a book one day. Or my favorite is, I've got an idea for a book you should write. Yeah. You know, that way, I've got the brilliance, but you've got the, you're willing to sit and type, and I've got the brilliance that will inspire you. And so there's so many people who want to write a book or are going to write a book, but if you have the compulsion and the willingness to do it, it's, I wish there was a magic to the ass in chair of, you know, getting a book done, and it just isn't. But again, it's that compulsion to continually sit in that chair, even when you realize this is a really miserable thing to be doing sometimes. And so I think through, I was writing for 20 years before I got published, and I wasn't spending a whole ton of time trying to get published. I was spending a lot more time writing just because I was raising kids and doing a lot of other things. But it was that compulsion to continue writing the stories and creating something. And I couldn't ignore it. So I just kept doing it. But I think that's a really amazing, it puts you, if you're willing to do that, a step above so many other people who aspire to do it and never do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's awesome.
Oh, that's great. All right, so I have one final question for Sarah and Angelina. This is a question I ask all of my guests. And it is, what is the most important book you've ever read and why? With you defining important however you see fit.
I have so many. I know, I have so many. I'll be shallow. I say shallow because I mean, I could point to a book I read last month and call it the most important book that I read, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do the one when I was probably in fourth grade, my school would send home this rickety piece of paper, like a newsprint, and a person could check a box and for a quarter get a book. And, you know, and my parents frequently had a gorgeous, gorgeous library in my house, floor to ceiling, hardwood, handcrafted, inlaid bookshelves filled with books, but they would tell me no because they were children. You know, they didn't want to spend money on the children's books or whatever, the pulpy books in the 70s. And one time in fourth grade, I was allowed to buy a book, and it was The Blue Sword by Robin McKinley, and it changed my life. It was a girl, woman, girl with a sword and a horse, and I wanted all three of them. And people say the first time you saw a book about yourself and yourself in a book. I've never seen myself in a book, right? I'm not sure I want to see myself in a book, frankly. You know, loudmouth, queer, multiracial, Jewish, Michigas. I'm not sure that I want to see myself in a book. But that was the first. That was the first book that really spoke to me and was like, "Girl, sword, horse." My life has changed. And then, of course, instead of invisible friends, I spent fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth grade with invisible horses that I would talk to in class. And they were all named. Yeah. I galloped them through the halls of middle school. Oh. Absolutely not kidding.
My book was definitely Jane Eyre. My uncle sent me a set of Wuthering Heights and Jane Eyre, and there was these beautiful books about this big with this really, really thin paper. And I started reading Jane Eyre on the bus. And here is this plain woman who had this inherent sense of herself, and that came across very immediately to everyone she was around. And it was so irritating to everybody, this inherent sense of who she was. And she goes to this place, and she meets this hot guy. And there is, I fundamentally think that's a feminist novel because the way she controls that relationship, the way he admires, wants her to bend and admires that she doesn't, it's really, really funny. There's incredibly intense, funny banter between the two of them. And ultimately, at the end of the day, she would rather starve on the moors and change her inherent sense of who she is. She is not the person that is going to marry a married man, because as miserable as it's going to make her to leave him, it will not be untrue to who she inherently is. That's worse. Being untrue to herself is worse than losing this man. And that book blew my mind and continues to blow my mind because of that reason. This woman is not going to change for him. And that book really defined like everything after that. Yeah.
Nice. Mine. Cool. Great. I always love hearing the answers to this question. One day I'm going to like put them all together so we can have them all in one video.
Oh, and I trust me, I know that me calling that a feminist novel will enrage some people, side note. So that's okay. That's why I asked for not the public comments on it.
Controversial opinion. Well, so yeah, far, no one in the comments has disagreed with you. So thank you both so much for joining us today. Sarah, you were actually like, when I first created the show, on my first list of people that I wanted to have on the show.
That's so sweet.
Yeah. And then someone, I can't remember who it was, tagged you when I asked, you know, who they wanted to see on the show. I was like, oh yeah, I should definitely send that invitation now. So, and then she brought along Angelina and Leslie, and it's been great having both of you as well. So Leslie and I are going to say goodbye to Sarah and Angelina, and we're going to finish up the show. So thank you all for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Bye. Have a good night. All right. That was great. That was a great conversation.
Yeah, they're amazing. Yeah, and everybody should definitely read Angelina's book because I loved Lush Money so much. And I was so waiting for the next one in the series.
Cool. I can listen to Sarah talk about the industry like all day. Like she should do a pub. What is it called?
TED Talk. Podcast. Yeah. Well, KT Literary has a podcast, if you guys don't know.
Oh, yeah.
Podcast, okay. And Sarah's been on it. It's great. Another one of the agents runs it. So they interview authors and other the agents in the agency. So it's really good stuff.
Yeah. Cool. Okay, so it's time for audiobook of the week. And we're also going to do, again, this week an audiobook giveaway. So I'm going to talk about the audiobook that I chose this week, and then we'll do the giveaway. So this week's audiobook is Kingsbane by Claire Legrand, which is actually the second book in the series. And I read the first book a while back, and I liked it enough to read the second, but I wasn't like, you know, a huge fan of it, right? But I liked it. But the second book, I really like it. Like, I probably like it more than the first book, which doesn't happen a lot in fantasy series, you know? But that's why it's the audiobook of the week, because I listened to it this past week while during my walks. It's about two queens separated by 1,000 years, connected by secrets and lies. They must continue their fight amid deadly plots and unthinkable betrayals that will test their strength and their hearts. And that's from the publisher. Of course, I didn't write that.
Does it stand alone, or do you have to read the first one first?
Huh?
Does it stand alone at all, or do you have to get the first one?
Oh, you definitely, you should definitely read the first one. That's why I added, when we do the audiobook away, you can choose any of my previous audiobooks of the week, including this one. And I actually added the first to the list. So if you haven't read the first one, you can get that one instead if you want to. So we're going to do again the, I'm thinking of a number between 1 and 50, and I'm going to put it in the private chat to Leslie so I don't cheat, and also so I can remember what it is. So 1 through 50, and after you guys go ahead and put your numbers in, and once I've read your number, you can then guess again. And so if no one gets it the first time, we can keep going until someone gets it. And it takes like 30 seconds for the comments to come through. So I'm just going to rattle on for a little bit until they start coming through. Last week, Ebony won, and she chose Hollywood Homicide, which was the last episode's audiobook of the week.
Someone recommended that book to me, so I guess I better read it.
Yeah, it's great. Kelly Garrett, the author, is also a friend of mine. Oh, cool. But when she said she was getting an audiobook made for it, I was like, oh, you should get, or I know that the author has no choice on the narrator or whatever, but I was like, oh, it'd be awesome if Bonnie Turpin could narrate it. And then it turns out that's who did it. Cool. 365, I said between 1 and 50 there. Oh, she has another one. Okay, 13, that is my lucky number though, 13. 17, Tamara, nope. 6, feel free to guess again now if I have said that is not your number. I think 17 was the last episode's number, if I'm remembering correctly. That was a long time ago. It was 2 weeks ago.
2 weeks is like a lifetime these days.
Yeah. All right. We have 42. Nope. 46. It was funny because the last time the second person I guessed got it. 1. Nope. Jessica said 25. Still no. One day we're going to hit it. Yeah, last time it was like the second person who guessed got it. And I was like, oh, maybe I need to make this harder. I guess that was just good luck. Right. 87. No, the max is 50. So between 1 and 50. Kelly said 25. Yeah, you re-guessed it in case I got it, picked it again. 1 to 50, Jay. 1 to 50. Jessica said 30. 50. No. This is going to keep going forever. Right. Okay. I can give you a smaller range and maybe that will make it go faster. So let's say 1 to 15. 1 to 15, 15. Hey, Ray. Thanks for joining us. 3. Cheryl got it. Yay. Yay. All right. So Cheryl, if you could send me a message on Twitter or Instagram, or you can go to pubtalk.live and find my email address there. However you want to do it, just contact me on there and I'll send you the list and we'll make that happen.
Congratulations.
Yeah, congrats, Cheryl. cool. Okay, so the viewer poll of this week was, let me pull it up on screen so everyone can see, how has your income publishing related not been impacted by COVID-19? 53% of people said, yes, I've lost income. 14% said my income increased. I almost didn't include this option, but then I decided there are probably some people making a little more money And then 43% said there's been no change. But that is a significant amount of people. Oh, I didn't realize, sorry, the picture is still over everything. My bad. There we go. Now you can see everything.
Because I think income, unless you've like lost your job immediately, like publishing income, it takes so long to get anyway.
Yeah.
You know, royalties come twice a year, or if you self-publish, it's 3 months later you get your money. So that part of it is you know, no change for a lot of people, but other income definitely. I mean,
mine hasn't changed much, primarily because I haven't published a book in 2 years, so I'm not really relying on publishing income right now. So it's just my day job income.
Yeah.
And also my, you know, my writing for Book Riot and stuff like that. Mine has increased. Kelly said mine has increased so far, but mainly I sell ebooks. So that's probably the reason.
Oh yeah.
People in certain segments for sure, I feel like, are making a little bit more money in publishing.
And I think that KU Reads have probably gone up because they're not spending any extra money, but they can read more. Mm-hmm. Oh, that at a certain point that'll go down because it's a pool of money, but
yeah. And then I know like children's activity books, the sales have skyrocketed for those. So
yeah,
if you're working in that industry, that's nice right now, probably. And then anyone who's like probably a delivery driver or someone like that, they're probably making more money, or if they're working right now,
yeah,
more probably. So,
and certain places are still hiring. Like I just saw the commercial that Domino's is hiring. So like,
I saw that too.
You could pick up a side hustle maybe.
Let's see. Celeste, that was a terrific show. Very informative. Thank you. So the last thing we do every episode, we're just going to close out with a reading quote of the week. And this is basically for no other reason than I like quotes. And, you know, so yeah. So the quote for this week is reading a book is like rewriting it for yourself. You bring to a novel anything you need, all your experience of the world. You bring your history and you read it in your own terms. I like it.
Yeah,
that's cool. Everyone has a different experience with different books, right? So,
and as authors, it's important to remember that too, because you can put all that stuff in there, but people are going to take what they take. So,
yeah, cool. I have a friend who reads some of my books, and she's always like, "You should do this. You should do this." Or, "I think this character is this. I think this character is this." Right. And I'm like, "No, that's not." And she's like, "Death of the author." Like, you can't say anything.
You have to be silent.
But one time she said, "I'm thinking this." And I was like, "Yeah, that's my headcanon." And she's like, "You're the author, then that's canon."
That's what we call that.
It's not headcanon. Well, Leslie, thank you so much for joining me. Check out Leslie. Leslie has an awesome YouTube channel, so make sure you go and check that out and find her on Instagram and Twitter. And do you do a podcast too? Was that you?
Yeah, the podcast is under the YouTube, so I just make a video while I'm recording. Yeah.
Yeah, so go check out her podcast as well. And you can find the link to her website down in the description down below. And thank you so much, Leslie. I'm going to say goodbye and close out the show.
Bye.
Bye. All right. Thank you everyone so much for watching and tuning in and commenting and, you know, just hanging out with us tonight. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to like and subscribe so you don't miss another episode. Tell your friends. You can also sign up for a subscription, an email in the description, and you can sign up for my Patreon, which the link is in the description. My dog is having like little, like a nightmare or something. He's like doing little barks while he sleeps, and it's so distracting. So the Patreon link for the Patreon is in the description. Thank you so much, my Patreon supporters. I love talking to y'all every week and getting the questions from you, and I really appreciate your support. You can find social media for all of the guests in the description, along with Pug Talk Live social media. And I took a picture of my animals who slept through the entire episode. I'll be posting that on Instagram. So go check that out after. Thank you so much for listening to this pre-recorded episode of Pub Talk Live. To find out more about the show and find out how you can watch live, go to pubtalk.live. Thank you so much to my Patreon podcast sponsors, Brenda Drake, Jay Lynn, and Reframe.